Welcome to What in God's Name. She is Shana Appel.
And he's Chris Owen.
We are on a mission to recast the narrative of our shared common life using theology and philosophy and psychology. We are pushing back against narrow partisan politics and misleading measures of economic prosperity that dominate our thinking about public life.
We are taking on the programmatic secularists who believe that religion is a private matter and should never be spoken of in public, as well as the theocrats who are fine with religion in the public square so long as it's theirs and theirs alone. To both of these groups, we say
no.
To the programmatic secularists, we say faith absolutely has a role to play in our common dialogue, and given the widespread and breadth of people here in the United States of America, we have to hear from as many voices as possible in order to truly know what's going on. To those who would have their religion and their religion alone in the public square, sorry, yours is just not the final word. None of ours is. So again, the more the merrier in the realm of American democracy.
What we're doing, Shana, is not easy because we are so saturated, we are so enculturated to think about our public life together in the frame of politics and economics. And so it's a little bit like your story of the fish in the water. We are trying to illuminate the water that we swim in and say, wait a minute, is this the water we want to be swimming in? Are these the stories we want to tell about our shared common life together? That is, the stories that are framed just by politics and economics. Or is there a better way? Is there a deeper story? Is there a way to lift up human flourishing and the flourishing of all creation? And we think there is. That's why we do this show.
Amen. Preach it, brother. We're going to begin today, as we often do, by giving the spinning wheel a little bit of a fly. I think it's my turn to run it today, Chris.
You go for it. Our spinny wheel is a piece of plywood. It has 16 different pieces of the pie. The wheel itself is a bicycle wheel with a sprinkler head pointer. And the pointer lands on one of those 16
All by way of saying, our spinny
slices.
Wheel is very high-tech.
High-tech spinny wheel. Think Wheel of Fortune meets, as you say, Swamp
Yankee. Yes.
Do it yourself, spinny wheel. The pointer has landed on plural, and that is a concept that you were just talking about in the show opener,
Yes.
Where we live in this amazing country, so many gifts, so much sorrow. We'll talk about some of that today in our history, and yet what's amazing about the possibility of this country that we live in is its plural nature. And can we successfully negotiate a plural society and hang together and be unified and not splinter off into all our little tribes? And that's a theological question. I mean, it's a question on a lot of different levels, but certainly it's it admits of theological analysis. What do we do with the differences and the diversity?
Well, and the binary conversation says something is either this or that, but in a pluralist society, one really has to be able to hold multiple ideas simultaneously. So that's the challenge, and here we go.
It is a great challenge.
Speaking of holding multiple ideas at one time.
It is a difficult challenge that we have in front of us.
It is. We are doing a series where we are diving deep into the idea of democracy, American democracy in particular. We might get to more generalized democracies later, but assume, please, that the democracy we're talking about on this show today is American democracy.
Democracy, my dear Shana, does democracy have a future, is a question we've been asking in the last two shows. We continue to ask it throughout this series. And last week, I said I was bearish on the future of democracy. And I listened back to that, back to what I said, and I was somewhat dissatisfied with what I said. And so I wanted to circle back to that and try to take it to a deeper level, reflecting.
You mean rather than just admit you were wrong? That's okay. So now Chris is going to try to fix what he said last week. Go for it, Chris. What I really meant to say was...
I'm feeling nonplussed by your little response there, which is great, which is wonderful. That's why you know, that's why you're here.
Yes, that's why you're. That's why I'm here.
To make me nonplussed. Does democracy have a future? I do that often, folks. If you listen to this show, I trip over my little words. Here's some thoughts, Shana, and I just tried to go deeper inside myself, and here's where I arrived. I love humanity. That is just true. I love humanity because of our brokenness. I am skeptical of trusting human goodness, and that is something I talked about last week. And that's deep in me, and it's certainly part of my story, like how I learned about the world, what I learned about the world and other people, and how I reflect on myself. I am skeptical of trusting human goodness. But I feel like that's a key difference between you and me. But you can I'll let you respond to that. That's just an observation I have as we've done this show now for a couple of years. I am skeptical of trusting human goodness. So then the question is, where is hope for me? And that's this. In the transcendent order is where I find hope, which human societies can only approximate at best. So I say transcendent order. For me, that's God. Hope is in God. So that's where hope is for me.
So if trust is in the transcendent order,
yeah,
and we don't live in the transcendent order,
yeah,
then, well, but we live in one of the least religious countries on the planet. So, you know, the vast majority of people are not engaged in that conversation.
And hence, we're in the difficulty we're in. That's what I would say.
Well, I wouldn't disagree with you there.
But let me say, you know, so this goes back to plural. When I take that into the public square, it has to be translatable into language that can be commonly held in a secular, that is not privileged one voice over another, public square. So transcendent order doesn't necessarily have to mean God in a public conversation, but it does require some vision of what is just and fair and good.
It does require some common commitment, right? Because without common commitment, if the common commitment is democracy, the common commitment is the beloved community or the kingdom of heaven that we're trying to build down on here on earth, but it has to have some collective agreements. You know, we have to have agreements on stuff, right? A game works because there is agreement on the field that the purpose here is to, you know, knock the little ball out of the park and run around the bases. The purpose of the game is to score touchdowns or, you know, to kick goals. Games work because there's a common understanding of what we're actually doing on the field. And I feel like, you know, when we talked about this a little bit last week, is what's happening in American democracy right now is what Tocqueville predicted was going to happen, was that states' rights were going to start to cloud the national raison d'etre. And beyond even states' rights, now we're in this place of toxic individuality where people's, you know, believe that their individual rights trump everything else. So yeah, it's a real challenge for a democracy, even one that's, you know, such as ours, a republic democracy.
Do you think that we are able to agree on the rules?
No.
Will we eventually be able to agree on the rules?
I certainly hope so.
Did we used to be able to agree to the rules?
I think we at least could agree on what was real.
And I wonder if part of how we were able to agree on the rules in the past was at the expense of certain people.
Well, that is very true. I mean, that is absolutely true.
I mean, we're pivoting to our topic today.
Right.
Part of the agreement that at one time held a subset of us really together in a democracy was putting down those people.
Not even considering them. So our topic for today is democracy at the intersection of race and racism in America. And one of the things that we were talking about in last week's show is that Tocqueville's observations of American democracy as recorded in his book, American Democracy, does not take into consideration at all, looks right past, pretends not to even see the fact of how many persons were enslaved in 1834 when he was here and writing. What the impact of slavery has been on American democracy. His book, while considered seminal, and I believe it is a seminal review in so many ways, but looks right past that. It never even gets a mention. And that's true really in a number of narratives about America, right? So for example, we have the narrative around the American Revolution, which started with a bunch of freedom-loving libertarians who had a party at South Church and then took it down to the Habba and tossed a bunch of tea overboard and thus kicked off an American Revolution in an effort to free us from being ruled by a distant sovereign. And that's the narrative of the American Revolution. There's another narrative of the American Revolution that suggests that the American Revolution happened, in fact, because England had already abolished slavery. And we are a young, up-and-coming democracy and with a burgeoning and a rapidly growing capitalist system that was growing and developing on the backs of enslaved African persons. So if England had abolished that already, and if we stayed tied to England, was England going to force us into abolition, which would have taken literally the rug right out from underneath all the production and growth that was happening in America? And I remember the first time I heard that suggested, I mean, it was a real, you know, moment for me because I'm born and raised in New England. I mean, I was born in Massachusetts. You know, that narrative lives deep. Paul Revere's ride through the streets of Concord and Lexington. But I think this parallel narrative has to be considered because whether it is true or not, I find it hard to believe that the so-called founding fathers, those who penned the Constitution, who were themselves all, wait for it, slave owners, were not somehow led, guided, misguided because how important the enslavement, the continued enslavement of certain individuals was to the continued economic growth of this country.
You know that that is a contested historical question.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't think we can afford in this day and age to look past it, particularly when we see vestiges of it in our current system. For example, you know, we talk about a company that is too big to fail. Right? So it doesn't matter how corrupt it is. It doesn't matter how many lives it has snuffed out in the process of becoming too big to fail. But we have this notion that there are just some companies that are going to be above and beyond the law because they are just too big to fail. And if they fail, it will bring down the American economic system and democracy with it. So I think it's worthy of our consideration. And again, in a pluralistic society, we have to be able to hold multiple interpretations simultaneously.
Yeah, I think I'm glad you said that because I would push back against a reading of history of our founding in 1776 as monocausal. Like the reason that the revolution happened and we declared our independence from England was one reason, and it was the reason to be able to perpetuate slavery. But that's what I would push back against.
I would push back against that also. I'm simply saying that this is, you know, another narrative that has to be considered in you know, the waft and the weave that is the tapestry of American history.
Do you think that the fact that founding fathers were slave owners, does that make less true the founding ideals of liberty and equality?
I think it casts shade, if you will. So the founding fathers had slaves and were keeping them enslaved. They did not free them. They did not say, I'm going to free you, but I'd like to hire you. So if you'd like to continue to work here, but that's your choice. And if you don't wish to do that, there are, you know, places you can go to, like Western Canada, for example, set up a very nice life for yourself. They didn't do that. So while I don't necessarily know how owning slaves impacted their thought precisely, it has to be figured in as part of the picture. Because I do think, I mean, and I said to you before we started recording today, I think in many ways racism is in America what water is to fish. It is so woven into the fabric in ways that we just don't see because we don't pay attention to those particular threads. We don't pay attention to those narratives.
The point I was driving at, and I don't disagree with what you say, it is woven into the story of American democracy. It's woven into our history. Pushing at this, that ideals like liberty and equality do not get diminished or falsified as ideals just because the fallible human beings who espouse those ideas are hypocrites. In fact, their hypocriticalness only highlights the ideal, the goodness of the ideal. And just, this is a minor detail, but George Washington did free his slaves.
Yes, he did.
So that's.
But you, I mean, then you're talking about, and this is your philosopher's head. Then you're talking about, you know, notions of liberty and equity as sort of abstract, because apart from how they're lived out, do they exist at all?
Well, what's an ideal? An ideal is something we aspire to. Again, this gets back to my sense of human beings as fallen, as mm-hmm. sinful. We have ideals. We are going to fall short of our ideals, but that doesn't tarnish the ideal. That tarnishes the hypocrite.
Well,
it shows how fallible we are.
And I will push back on that simply because there are those who hold those ideals very differently. Their interpretation of those ideals, their interpretation of liberty is very screwed up. You know, when it comes to the ideal notion of freedom is I get to exercise my God-given right to, you know, stockpile firearms and ammunition. And that is their ideal. So in that sense, to say, you know, that the ideal of liberty and freedom, yes, okay, many of us can agree on maybe what the ideal looks like, but all of us can't agree on what the ideal looks like. So where does the ideal actually live? Ooh, there's a philosophical question.
It is, but it's important because your example, someone who values freedom and says, basically you've defined a negative freedom, like I'm free and screw everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a freedom problem or is that a person problem? I say it's a person problem. Freedom is corrupted in that that's not free. You know, it's a corruption of the concept of freedom. So freedom.
I don't disagree with you.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't disagree with you. But I think the challenge is, you know, like, how do you tell people you're just plain crazy wrong? I mean, you're just out of your freaking mind. This is, you know, I was watching Rachel Maddow the other day, 2 days ago, because it was the day before the, you know, the election in California. And the guy, the right-wing talk show host who was running against Gavin, it's his last name, King. But they posted on his website a whole thing about how his followers should object to the outcome of the election. The vote had not happened yet. The vote was going to take place the next day. Yet the day before the vote, they posted this whole thing that followers so object and votes were stolen and they should call for a, you know, a recount and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Not even on the page of reality. And there are people who are going to read that and they're going to run with it, even though it was written the day before a single vote had been cast.
I'm not following the point.
That is there any, okay, maybe we're saying the same thing. Is there any hope for democracy? Is there any hope for the ideal of anything when you've got people who are in an alternate reality? And maybe that's what you're saying is like, yes, human beings are fallen. And so therefore the ideal takes a hit. Can we still hold on to the ideal? Well, who the hell knows? Because we'd have to agree on what the ideal is. And I don't know that we have that agreement. I mean, we do in pockets of people, but there certainly isn't a global appreciation for what that means.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that resonates with my whole sense of the psychotic nature of the current moment.
That is well diagnosed, my friend. The psychotic nature of the current political moment? Yes.
And what is a theological reflection on psychosis? I think the theological reflection is that, or a, not the, a theological or moral reflection on the psychotic moment is that we need to be firm in the truth as we know the truth. I mean, that I'm channeling Abraham Lincoln in his second inaugural. Like, there is no space to be weak-kneed about what we know is real about the world, because there are people in our society who are denying what is real. And that is a recipe for huge disaster. So a theological reflection is that we need to put on the armor of God, to channel the Apostle Paul. For those of you who are not Christian, stand in the truth.
Mm-hmm.
That's a theological, but the fact that there are people lying doesn't mean that there's no truth.
Right. And I guess, and I'll defer back to Parker Palmer in Healing the Heart of Democracy here, where, you know, the way forward is through compassion. And theologically, I mean, we see how Jesus handles, for example, the demoniac, right? Or people who are despised or cast out. You know, Jesus has a way of bringing them in and having compassion and continuing to stand in what he knew to be the truth until, or, you know, as it's been said, you just speak to the God within until the God within shows up, which is really challenging. But it is definitely a challenge. And where, particularly where racism in America is concerned, it's so much of it relies on going back and adding to the stories that already exist, because there are so many stories that are not being told. You know, we don't learn about, for example, all of the legislation from the Slave Act, all of the legislation that has gone on that has kept the BIPOC community in particular down, kept us from enjoying the full fruits of democracy. You know, we tried to pass anti-lynching laws and we couldn't get those through Congress. The list goes on and on and on about how inequality has actually been legislated. And there is no way to have a conversation about American democracy without looking at that and what its impact has been. There's a narrative for you.
I want to pick up this conversation with you next week. Democracy in the United States, just to back out to 10,000 feet for a second, it's a continuing story. And our conversation, to me, points that up and brings it home. And for our listeners and for the public at large, we all have to be engaged if we want that story to what? To have a happy ending? To
involve all people. Yeah, that the hope, yes. That, yeah. You know, that the hope of America, the ideal of this pluralistic nation, might be reached someday.
We are still writing the story of American democracy.
True enough. And towards that end, Chris, keep questioning.
And go deep.
And shine light.
Our show today is brought to you by our generous donors on Patreon. We do invite you, we ask you, to join our generous donors on Patreon. Help us to feed our associate producer, Brandon Edwards, our newest team member. And we do ask you, Brandon asks you, as our associate producer for outreach, please go to Apple Podcasts, to Stitcher, to Spotify, wherever you can access podcasts, and leave us a review. It's helpful to us as we continue to build our show and get it out into the world. Leave us a review. You can check us out also at our website, whatingods.com, which is
WHATINGODS.
Great to see you, Shayna.
Always great to see. Now I'm doing it. Always great to see you, Chris.
All right.